listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents God Hears, the sermon by the Reverend Gene Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, June 25th, 2017.
Back in the days when I was a graduate student at the University of Virginia, David and I lived not in Charlottesville, but over in the Shenandoah Valley, where he was serving a church. It was a beautiful little church in a tiny dairy farming community between the Blue Ridge Mountains and Massanutten Peak. It was a gorgeous place to live. But it wasn't always an easy fit for this fast-talking northern city girl to be the pastor's wife in that place. I learned to slow my cadence down just a bit, soften and lengthen a vowel here or there, to keep a pitcher of sweet tea in my refrigerator at all times. And I learned to keep the radio in the kitchen of the parsonage pre-programmed not just to NPR, which I liked to listen to as I cooked, but also to the local country radio station, so that when parishioners popped by, which they did regularly, without knocking, it was a parsonage, they owned it, they just came in, and I could quickly change the station. NPR was just a step too far for them. Every time I read today's lectionary text this past week, I heard a song from that station echoing in my head. I won't sing it for you, but the refrain goes like this. They roll by just like water, and I guess we never learn. We go through life parched and empty, standing knee-deep in a river and dying of thirst. This lectionary reminded me of that, not just the piece that we read today, but this whole saga of Abraham and Sarah. All of them standing knee-deep in refreshing water, parched and dying of thirst, and unwilling to see the water that was there. We go back to this complicated family of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar and their sons Ishmael and Isaac. And there's way more to the story, so let me just reorient us briefly. As the saga begins, God sends Abram on a holy mission. You see, God's beloved creation has been a bit of a rum go. Adam and Eve had behaved in a most unsatisfactory manner and had to be expelled from the Garden of Eden. Not satisfied with all they had been given, they wanted the one thing denied to them. Cain, seeing God's regard for his brother Abel, was so jealous of what his brother had, they killed him and then was consigned to wander. Things went from bad to worse among the people, so bad that God attempted to reboot the whole shebang with an enormous flood. Next, the people, unified with one language, got uppity and decided to build a tower to heaven so that they could control even more. They could command whatever they wanted with a tower that high. God stepped in and divided their speech and scattered them. Finally, God chose Abraham to be the founder of a great nation that would bless all the people of the earth and bring these people back together. God intends to redeem the whole mess through Abraham. Despite the fact that the family Abraham comes from is a bit of a mess itself. And the wife, Sarah, that he took with him, she was also his half-sister. It was messy. They settled in the land God showed them, but before long, famine hit, and they were forced to travel to Egypt where there was food. And on the way, Abraham said to Sarah, "Sarah, my wife, you are so beautiful. It may be that some of the Egyptians will see you and desire you and kill me. So protect me. Say that I am your sister." Having no recourse, Sarah complies and ends up a concubine in the household of Pharaoh. And Abraham? Well, he ended up rich. He received sheep and oxen, male donkeys, male and female slaves, female donkeys, and camels. It's quite a list. But then things started to go not so well in the household of Pharaoh. He and all of his people are hit by plagues, which they struggle to figure out. They can't understand why this is happening. And when Pharaoh discovers that Sarah is in fact married, he assumes that this is the reason, and he is distraught. He does not, as Abraham feared, kill Abraham. He sends them packing home, and Abraham gets to keep all the loot. When they get home, one of the slaves they have with them is Hagar. Now, according to some legends, Hagar had been a princess living in the house of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh had given Hagar to Sarah and Abraham as a sort of consolation prize as he's pushing them homeward. Others have speculated that Hagar was a servant in Pharaoh's household, and that when she met Sarah, she fell in love with Sarah's God and wanted to go with her so that she could continue to worship that God. Our text doesn't really tell us a lot about Hagar's past. But as biblical scholar Will Gaffney has pointed out, what we do know for sure is that when they return home, Hagar is with them. And Sarah, a product of the same patriarchy that informed Abraham's treatment of her, Sarah turns and subjugates another woman. Sarah employs the lessons she learned in her father's house against Hagar, and to some degree, even against Abraham. Sarah will seize the body of a girl she considers her property and subject her to physical and sexual violence and a forced pregnancy, while turning the tables on the husband who sold her cheap for camels and donkeys and sheep. Sarah's abuse of Hagar will become so violent, so oppressive, that it is described with the same word that Exodus uses to describe Egyptian oppression and affliction of the Israelites, a word that includes rape as one of its primary meanings. The lesson of patriarchy, like the lesson of white supremacy, is that there is not enough, that all of God's good abundance is not enough, and that some must seize power and control to protect their own access, access to what they perceive as the scarcity in the world. Before Hagar's child is even born, Sarah is filled with bitterness and regret and abuses her. Because in the economy of this patriarchal home, a woman's worth is measured by the children she is able to bear. Now Hagar has worth that Sarah can never have. Sarah believes. Hagar, who has been separated from her family and is far from home and has been subjected to this marriage without any consent on her part, finds her worth in having a child, in expecting a child. Sarah finds a Hagar who feels worthwhile, unbearable. The way our Bible tells it, Hagar gets uppity and Sarah gets nasty. Hagar and the child growing in her womb flee to the wilderness, the desert beyond Abraham and Sarah's camp, and she stops beside a spring. As she bends down to take a drink of water from that spring, a messenger of God speaks to her. I can imagine she had quite a story to tell, whether she had been given by Pharaoh as a slave or had gone willingly because she wanted to worship God. It has not gone well for her in the home of Sarah and Abraham. It's a story of desolation and distress. And God's response to her is, "Go back. This wilderness is no place for a woman who is expecting a child. Go back and submit to Sarah." But as God sent her back, God equipped her too with a promise that is parallel to the one he gave Abraham. God said to Hagar, "I will so greatly multiply your offspring that they cannot be counted." At that moment, Hagar looks up at the messenger of God standing before her face, and she says, "You are Elroy, the God who sees. Hagar names God. Let's sit with that for a moment. A person in exile, a runaway slave, a stranger in the land, a refugee, a person undocumented in the Abrahamic tradition, is the one who gives a name to God, the only one in all of Scripture who gives a name to God. Hagar returns to Abraham and Sarah's camp, fortified by the promise she received, and maybe just a little bit emboldened by her act of naming God. The scene shifts and time passes. The child born to Hagar approaches adolescence, and the child born at last, at long last, to Sarah is old enough to wean. So Abraham holds a weaning feast, because this means that the child is robust and will probably live if he has lived to the years, to the age of weaning. And at that feast, Sarah is again seized with an unreasoning fear and anger as she watches the two boys play. Although Abraham is wealthy, although they have prospered in the land, she is enraged with fear that Ishmael, born first, will inherit. She is furious even at the idea that the inheritance will be split between Abraham's two sons, her son and the son of Hagar. She demands that Abraham cast Hagar and Ishmael out of the household altogether. And this is where we meet Hagar in today's reading. After everything that she has endured, slavery, forced concubinage, an escape into the wilderness only to be sent back, and a return to slave status, now she is alone and insufficiently supplied. She cannot bear to watch the death of her son, and so she goes a bowshot away, about the length of a football field, so that she cannot see him and she cannot hear him. But the God who saw her distress is also the God who hears. Ishmael is the name of her son, and it is the words that mean God hears. And this God who hears her assures her that the promise she received is still true. They will live and thrive and be the ancestors of countless people. Where before she saw only desert and hopelessness and lonely death, she suddenly sees flowing water and life and a future. Now, the biblical text is not shy about claiming miraculous provision by the hand of God. So I think it would not be shy about making the claim that God had suddenly produced water where none had been before. But it doesn't say that. Instead, it says that Hagar's eyes were opened, and she suddenly saw what had been there all along, enough water to sustain her and her son. And it is this question of human perception of scarcity in a land of abundance that has been nudging at me all week long. The river we human beings are all standing in, parched and dying of thirst. The lie that patriarchy tells us is that women, as people, are not enough. The lie that white supremacy tells us is that there is not enough value or honor or power, and that people with white skin must hold power over everyone else in order to protect their access. The lie that capitalism tells us is that you can never have enough stuff, and that without more stuff, your life will be empty and meaningless, that more and more and more is the only way to fill you. The lie that hypernationalism tells us is that there is not enough in the country, and that only the people we identify as us and our kind can be protected, provided for, and count in the long run. These lies conspire to keep even those of us who don't believe them off kilter, afraid of scarcity and thirsty for more. It's sort of a constant drumbeat underneath everything. God's story is one of abundance, There is enough in God's good creation for all the people of the earth to have what they need, to live freely, to eat, to create art, to have housing and clothing, to study and invent and live abundantly. There is enough. Shot straight through God's story is the story of human beings who cannot, will not believe that there will be enough. So instead of sharing what is enough, we are driven by fear to hoard it. And as we think about Hagar, the immigrant, the enslaved, the refugee, it makes me pay attention to the way we talk about immigration. Even those of us who want to accept immigrants into this country sometimes tend to think of this as sort of a holy burden that we will give from our much to their little, instead of thinking of all that immigrants have to offer us, the work, art, creativity, intelligence, culture, music, commitment, all that their lives bring to us. Instead of that, we see drain, which we, on our side, nobly will bear. This sacred story of the betrayed Hagar, sent packing by Sarah's fear of scarcity, comes to life in the lives of ordinary people. People that we meet along the way, or maybe one of us. Hagar takes the shape of a pack-laden homeless man riding his rickety bike down the streets of Portland, looking for a place to pitch his tent after the latest sweep of his favorite camping place. Hagar dogs our memories as that weird kid no one wanted to sit by or eat with or pick for a sports team. Hagar appears in the face of a woman who waits with her husband, afraid of what will happen to their children if the ICE agents who are stopping their car arrest them. Hagar languishes in an immigration detention center where guards address her not by her name, but by the number of her bed. Hagar is in the face of a frightened Guatemalan mother taking sanctuary in a church so that she won't be deported back to a country that is violent. Hagar is in the face of the Afghani man who sometimes worships at Bethel, a former translator for American troops who cannot get the documents he needs to bring his wife to this country, who cannot keep her safe from where he is. May the God of abundance give us eyes to see the springs of life-giving water right in front of us. May the God of enough and more than enough give us the will and the way to overcome our fear of scarcity and to live the good news story that our lives, our souls and minds and joy will be complete when we work to ensure that everyone has enough from God's overflowing abundance. Amen.
Listen, listen, listen.